It's the takeaway for August 22nd.
In my opinion, you vote for a Democrat, you're being very disloyal to Jewish people, and you're being very disloyal to Israel.
President Trump's comments about American Jews over the past few days have resurfaced old anti-Semitic stereotypes.
They were viewed as not the indigenous or the real or the legitimate people of the place.
We get the political and historical context behind the outrage against Trump's comments. Also on the show, the Trump administration is trying to undo the Flores Agreement, which provides key protections for migrant children. Plus, Howard University is teeing off a new golf program. We'll talk about the efforts to open up golf and other sports to new communities. Let's get started. On Tuesday, President Trump attracted plenty of scrutiny for his comments about American Jews after being asked if the U.S. should reconsider its aid to Israel.
Where has the Democratic Party gone? Where have they gone where they're defending these two people over the state of Israel? And I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
The president doubled down on the comment on Wednesday, telling reporters, quote, if you want to vote Democrat,
you're being very disloyal to Jewish people and you're being very disloyal to Israel.
The comments came after Israel banned Democratic House Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar from entering the country. After President Trump tweeted that allowing the two to visit would, quote, show great weakness, he also accused the two of hating Israel and all Jewish people. While President Trump is attempting to win over Jewish voters by accusing the Democrats of anti-Semitism, using the language of disloyalty against Jews in itself is a stereotype that dates back centuries. Joining me now is Hasia Diner, a professor of American Jewish history at NYU. Hasia, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So Jewish people have been called politically disloyal for centuries. The president is not the first one to use this, both in the United States and elsewhere. Why has this trope been so persistent?
The trope has been persistent in large measure as a reflection of historical realities. That is, Jews were, for the most part, always a people apart. That is, they lived in predominantly Christian societies or predominantly Muslim societies. They were sometimes the only non-Christians or non-Muslims living there. And despite the fact that in some of these places they had been there for centuries, they were viewed as not the indigenous or the real or the legitimate people of the place, France, Germany, Russia, whatever, they stuck out. And in that, they were, as the word is now, othered. And they were viewed also as people who were constantly on the move. And again, there's a grain of truth in that Jews were very much a migratory people. And when things got tough or when opportunities beckoned elsewhere, they migrated. And in a way, on top of that, they did live in a kind of transnational, diasporic collectivity, and that Jews in France and Jews in Morocco had a bond with each other. Jews in Spain, Jews in the Ottoman Empire had a bond with each other. And for many people who lived very locally, that seemed strange. In good times, it was not a problem. But when times got tough, when there were wars, when there was international conflict, when there were serious dips in the economy, then those people, okay, the ones who seemed to not really be part of this society, were not only very easy targets, but often accused of siding with that other hostile force. I mean, World War I was an incredible example of this, because the Jews of Central Europe who lived in that kind of complex parts of the Austro-Hungarian and the Tsarist Empire, when one side moves in, the Jews are accused of being collaborators with the other. When the other side moves in, no, Jews are the collaborators with the other enemy. And they were, for the most part, people who were just trying to stay alive and always accused of disloyalty.
So when we think about the history that you just laid out, how does that shape what the president said this week about American Jews being disloyal to Israel? And why would the president invoke loyalty to Israel in particular?
So I think this represented a new moment in time. I think historians, if there are still historians in the future, will look back at this as something truly sui generis. He was not, I think, as I heard the statement several times, he was not so much saying they were disloyal to the United States, but that they were disloyal to Israel. And as such, he's saying they're not good Jews, which causes me to think that what's going on is he's not really speaking to Jews. He's not trying to convince Jews to be more supportive of Israel, but I think he's speaking to his Christian fundamentalist base that has, for reasons that, again, are historically deep and dense and complicated, taken on the cause of Israel as part of their kind of eschatological end of the world, second coming kind of vision for the future, which is fundamental to their politics. In that context, he's weaponizing the status of Jews in the United States in a way that no president ever has. There's absolutely no parallel.
He's also said something I don't think any president has also said. And on Wednesday, President Trump thanked a noted conspiracy theorist on Twitter for saying that in Israel, the Jewish people love Trump, and I'm quoting here, quote, like he's the king of Israel. They love him like he's the second coming of God. These are the words of the conspiracy theorist. How do we make sense of that? I mean, this is unprecedented.
Extremely unprecedented. And in a sense, both phrases that you're quoting here are really loaded. And so first, the idea he's the king of Israel. Okay, so, I mean, this is really Christian language. And, Herod says that Jesus is, you know, the king of the Jews. That is totally directed at this Christian evangelical base, and the idea of the second coming, that's at the core of what the evangelicals are about, which is a kind of message that someday in the future, okay, all the Jews will be gathered in their homeland, and when that happens, there will be the second coming. Their support for Israel grows not out of a sense of Jews, like all other nations, deserve a homeland, just like the French deserve a homeland or the Italians deserve a homeland. But the Jews need a homeland because this prepares the ground for the second coming of Christ.
We did ask some of our Jewish listeners for their reactions to President Trump's statement from this week, and I want to play a clip of what one of them had to say and their reaction.
This is John Cooper calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, questioning our loyalty, et cetera. It's just a sign of his thin skin. We reject him consistently and overwhelmingly according to all available data. He thinks we should be grateful for these gifts to Netanyahu. He doesn't get that we care about his other horrible policies more than these gifts.
What are your thoughts on John's comment?
I think they're spot on also, because in making those statements, Trump is also addressing Jews. And he's saying essentially, remember, because the first part of his statement, of Trump's statement, was they're misinformed or they don't really know how important Israel as a kind of bastion of Jewish nationalism is for them. They don't know how bad Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are. They're misinformed. And I'm going to tell them because I know so much. And if you Jews really knew what was good for you as Jews, you would support me. Jews, I think in the last presidential election, were about 76% for Hillary, which is about what it's been for decades on a variety of issues that have nothing to do with Israel, a government that is involved in extending services to all people, okay, to take care of the poor, to ease class tensions, a state which is neutral as much as that's possible on issues of race, religion, ethnicity, and that what should matter is the individual, and a state which attempts to maximize economic opportunity for all. Okay, I mean, that's what Jews have voted on.
President Trump and the Republican Party have particularly been singling out Muslim politicians like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar for their views on Israel. Is that new?
Well, the entry of Muslims, individuals, and in fact, the emergence of something of a Muslim voting bloc in the United States is a reflection of the great migrations starting with the 1970s, the changes in the immigration laws, which opened up the possibility of migrating from the lands which are made up of Muslims. And so that these communities are developing and they're becoming politically active and conscious, as all immigrants have always been. What's new is the degree to which this newly coalesced population is in existence, and how, I think certainly in the face of 9/11 and the I think tremendous Islamophobia in the United States, the fear that Islam, so-called radical Islam, is going to challenge basic American values, they are very easy targets. And that people like Trump do not realize, or they don't see, that Muslim voters and politicians like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and so on are behaving just like all immigrant voting blocs have since really the beginning of the nation. And here are two individuals who have taken very, I think, bold steps and made themselves very prominent, understandably representing not just their constituencies, but certain values. And they are sitting ducks for people like Trump.
We've also seen some Jewish groups in the United States take very vocal stances against, for example, what's happening with children at the southern border, asking to close the camps, if you will, protesting against ICE raids. Could that also be playing into what we're seeing here?
I think Trump sees the one very large segment of the American Jewish population, including some who are themselves very supportive of Israel, but still opposing him on the kinds of issues which really do speak very deeply to Jewish history and to the kind of consciousness. And so I, not to make a plug for a particular organization, but HIAS, which was founded in the late 19th century as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, has reinvented itself and said, look, there are no longer Jewish refugees, but we're staying in business because we believe in the rights of refugees. And we want to do for refugees now and for people coming in what in the late 19th century and early 20th century, really into the 1930s and 40s, we did for our own. You know, never again. We can't sit back and allow the government in our names to treat people this way.
Hasia Diner is a professor of American Jewish history at NYU. Hasia, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Hi, my name is Carol. I'm calling from DuPont, Washington. Trump's statement only illustrates more deeply his racism, and he is using this to attack both the Democrats and Jews.
Hi, my name's Josh from Rochester Hills, Michigan. I think President Trump is 100% right, and as an American Jew, I've been saying the same thing for two decades.
This is Audria Hollander in Portland, Oregon. Trump will forever be Trump. This is another of his political moves to shame Jews not to vote for Democrats in 2020.
My name is Paul from Tampa, Florida. I find those comments to be very offensive. As a Jewish person myself, I don't like to be told how to vote. I like to pick my own party and to pick my own candidates. I feel that Mr. Trump is being very divisive as always. These remarks will not help anyone, especially those of the Jewish faith. And personally, there's absolutely no way I could vote in good conscience for the man now with these comments.
Aloha. My name is Michelle, and I'm calling you from Honolulu, Hawaii. And as usual, Trump speaks out of both sides of his mouth. I believe he is a white supremacist who plays Jews and Muslims against each other for his convenience. I'm a Jew and a lifelong Democrat. I do not owe loyalty to Trump. He forgets that our loyalty is to the Republic, not to the individual holding the office of the president.
In 1997, following years of litigation, the federal government under President Bill Clinton agreed to what would come to be known as the Flores Settlement Agreement, a decision outlining protections for migrant children, including a 20-day limit on how long they could be held in immigration detention facilities, after which they would be released to a guardian or licensed care facility. On Wednesday, the Trump administration proposed dramatic changes to the Flores Agreement, including allowing the government to hold migrant families in indefinite detention. Here's Kevin McAleenan, acting Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security.
After nearly 2 years of work by the Department of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services professionals, consideration of over 100,000 comments from stakeholders and members of the public, and a comprehensive review, the Trump administration has established a new rule to respond to the realities of current immigration flows, a rule based in the principle that families should remain together during immigration proceedings.
The Trump proposal is expected to be challenged in court. Joining us now is Laura Morrell, immigration reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me on.
And we also have Katie Shepard, the National Advocacy Council with the American Immigration Council. Thanks for joining us, Katie.
Hi, glad to be here. Thank you.
Laura, let's take a step back for a minute. How did the Flores Agreement come to be? I mean, what were the circumstances that led to this agreement?
Yeah, I think the best way to understand what the Flores Agreement is to go back and look at how it got started. It happens back in the 1980s when there was a large influx of children that were coming to the border to seek asylum. A lot of these children were actually coming from El Salvador, which was going through a civil war at the time. And basically what happened was the government was placing these children essentially in motels without any sort of set standards. And the children were also subject to body cavity searches. So what the Flores Agreement is basically the result of several lawsuits that were filed on behalf of these children. And the Flores Agreement sets specific standards to make sure that children are protected when they're in the custody of the United States.
Katie, we just heard McAleenan say in his statement announcing the proposed changes that this would help families stay together, that he says families belong together. But if these new changes end up taking effect, how would the current process for asylum for families with children be affected?
Yeah, thanks, Tanzina. So what we will likely see if the regulations are finalized, which we anticipate they will be as soon as tomorrow, we may see the indefinite detention of families and children in government custody. We maintain that this would actually violate both the terms and the spirit of the Flores Settlement Agreement, which required that the government must release a child without unnecessary delay if the child has somewhere to go.
Katie, help me understand a little bit of the legal process here. We know you said this could be implemented as early as tomorrow, but would this breaking of the Flores Agreement not be challenged in court?
Well, so it will likely be finalized tomorrow and published in the Federal Register, but it first has to go back to federal judge Dolly G, who oversaw the original Flores Settlement Agreement, and she has 60 days to review the implementing regulations and decide whether or not it does actually implement the Flores Agreement. In addition, we anticipate that the regulations will also be challenged in court as well.
Laura, we mentioned the history of the Flores Agreement, but what about the Flores Agreement under the Obama administration? How did Obama implement this while he was in office?
Well, the Flores Agreement, as you said, has been in place for two decades, and it was around during the Obama administration. It was also really crucial during another influx of children at the border back in 2014. And what happened at the time was the court basically interpreted the Flores Agreement to mean that children cannot be held in custody for more than 20 days. So that's sort of the thresholds that we're at right now. But if the Trump administration rules are put into effect, that 20-day limit will no longer exist. I also think it's really important to understand that Flores allows a core group of lawyers that advocate for the rights of these children to access these facilities. And it's really unclear right now whether the new rules will include this kind of provision. And that causes a lot of concern for advocates and lawyers.
Katie, we've been seeing reports of conditions in Customs and Border Protection facilities, but under these changes, the families, we understand, would be in ICE custody. Tell us what that would look like, and really where would these families be detained if they're being detained indefinitely? Would this require the building of new facilities?
Yeah. So there's currently 3 family detention centers in operation in the United States with a total bed space of over about 3,300. The largest facility is located in Dilley, Texas, about 70 miles south of San Antonio, and holds 2,400 mothers and their minor children. So it's conceivable that if and when these regulations are finalized tomorrow and begin to be implemented, that many of the families will be held in these family detention centers that are already in operation.
Laura, let's talk. Continue a little on politics here. A few weeks ago, the Democrats agreed to give the Trump administration more money for so-called border security. Should they have held out given this latest move by the Trump administration?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is that the current government is reacting to what's happening at the border with enforcement, as opposed to looking at it as a humanitarian crisis. One thing that we've continued to see at the border that we saw over the summer was the overcrowding of border facilities that are known as hieleras for immigrants that stay at these different facilities. They were overcrowded. We've heard of freezing temperatures, and we heard cases of children that were there in dirty clothes and hadn't been able to get access to medical care. So I think that, you know, for Democrats, I think a big thing here is to think of this more from a humanitarian standpoint than anything else.
Laura Morrell is an immigration reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And Katie Shepard is the National Advocacy Council with the American Immigration Council. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Warrior superstar Steph Curry made waves earlier this week when he announced a plan to take on some of this gap, announcing a big donation to help create a golf program with scholarships at Howard University. But one program at a historically black college won't fix the NCAA's inequity problem. I spoke with two guests about this issue. Sahil Desai is associate editor at The Atlantic, and Dr. Willis Jones is associate professor at the University of Kentucky College of Education. And Willis started by giving me his reaction to Steph Curry's donation to Howard.
I thought it was great. There's a real kind of feel-good element to the story that I think is really cool. You have a Howard student reaching out to one of the biggest superstars in the world. And from that relationship, they're able to bring a sizable donation to the university. So I think that's why many news outlets picked it up, is because it has this really great kind of feel-good element to it. There were two aspects of the partnership that really stood out for me, however. One was the fact that you had a African-American celebrity who did not attend a historically black college give a sizable donation to a black college. The second part that stood out for me was I started to ask myself, well, I wonder where Howard was going to find students, especially non-white students, if that was their interest, to play golf at the institution, because golf, like many other sports, has seen a pretty significant decline in youth participation over the last 10 years, especially when it comes to low income and people of color. And that's in part due to the expense of the sport and the other elements play into it. So I began to think about how strategic Howard was going to be when it came to recruiting student athletes for those positions on the golf team. So I think those are the things that really stood out to me when I first heard about the story.
Sahil, let's talk about other universities and collegiate level sports. When we're talking about things like golf or crew or lacrosse in particular, those are the ones that really come to mind that really extend themselves to scholarship opportunities for students. Who are we talking about? What kinds of students really make up this type of athletic demographic?
Well, we're overwhelmingly talking about white students here. I think there's this tendency to assume that lots of college athletes are African American or students of color, and that's definitely true in the high-profile sports, namely football and basketball. But if you get beyond that, lots of the sort of, frankly, country club sports that are at these universities are overwhelmingly white. So, for example, something like 85% of NCAA lacrosse players are white, 90% of ice hockey players. I think it's something like 77% of golf players are white. So overwhelmingly, these college athletes tend to be affluent white students.
You've also written in your piece at The Atlantic that college sports at elite schools in particular are, and I'm using your, you're saying they're calling them a, quote, affirmative action for affluent white students. It's interesting that when we talk about college sports, often we do, the focus is on black athletes and whether or not they, you know, quote unquote, deserve to get into the school that they got into because they're there on a sports scholarship. But the same analysis often doesn't apply to white students. Sahil, can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by affirmative action there for white students?
Yeah, I think lots of these white students, when they come to campus as athletes, they get an admissions bump in the process that's somewhat analogous to the bump that other racial minorities get in what we call affirmative action. And the types of bumps that tend to be critiqued a lot, especially on the right. And I think the admissions bump for athletes just doesn't tend to be talked about in the same way, even though based on the research that I've seen, the bump that's given to athletes tends to be much larger than the bump that is given to racial minorities or legacy applicants, which are also critiqued heavily.
Well, there's a lot of times when students get sports scholarships for the sports they play, does it always mean that they're getting a full ride to the university? Does that translate into everything being paid for? And extending on that, who would really benefit from this scholarship fund from Steph Curry?
Absolutely not. So I think one of the misnomers is that student athletes receive full scholarships no matter what sport they play. And that's simply not the case. Once you get outside of the quote unquote revenue sports, so basketball and football, most student athletes are on partial scholarships. And I think there's some data that would suggest that the vast majority of student athletes actually graduate with somewhere in the area of about $12,000 in student loan debt. And so the vast majority of people who would be able to take advantage of that are going to be individuals who, one, played golf early in life. And those tend to be individuals who are a little bit more affluent. But they also would have to be able to cover the remaining cost of going to college even when they get that partial scholarship. And so I think that Howard would need to be very strategic about reaching out to individuals from low socioeconomic backgrounds if they want to use these scholarships to maybe bring a little bit more socioeconomic diversity into the sport, which from what I've read is one of the things that Steph Curry wanted to do in sponsoring the program at Howard.
And I'm wondering, Willis, how does that translate into who ends up getting to benefit from scholarships? If these kids aren't able to, if low-income kids in particular, or kids of color, or both, aren't able to start accessing these programs, these sports early on, you know, what does that say about the class diversity that we see in a lot of these universities, in HBCUs in particular?
Well, as mentioned earlier, I mean, once you get outside of football, basketball, and track and field, the vast majority of NCAA student athletes are white. Some 70% are white. So you see that those scholarships that are put forward, and these are often, it's not something that I think the NCAA promotes very heavily. I think they, part of their identity is this idea that if you have the talent and you have the will to be a good athlete and student, then anyone is going to be able to come in and get access to college through athletics. And while that is the case in a lot of instances, the vast majority of individuals who are able to take advantage of some of the scholarship money that's available are white students and are affluent students. And I think we saw a lot of this manifest itself in the recent college admission scandal that we saw. A vast majority of those instances, you had a situation where a student was supposedly playing a country club sport and getting an admissions bump from that, where the coaches were vouching for him after coaches were paid under the table and things of that sort. So it just kind of highlights who's able to take advantage of that. And it's usually going to be individuals who are a bit more affluent and that are white.
Dr. Willis Jones is an associate professor at the University of Kentucky College of Education, and Sahil Desai is an associate editor at The Atlantic. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for this week, everyone. Duarte Geraldino is in for Amy Walter tomorrow. And I want to give a shout out to our team, producers Alex Boti, Isabel Angel, Rob Gunther, Jose Olivares, Polly Irungu, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, Danny Lewis, and Andres O'Hara. Deidre Depke is our executive producer, Jay Cowett is our director, and Vince Fairchild is our engineer. Jeeva Gavarma is our intern, and David Gable is our assistant. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.